Ah, here we are, springtime, April 2022. And what a fine trio of regenerates are here for Cultivated Audio. Drew Leach has been trialing both spring and fall seeded cover crops. Brad Lancaster is sharing about rainwater harvesting. And David Yarrow, who may have coined that word regenerates, is sharing about dowsing. I'm Robin Clare. Grab a shovel and or your earbuds and let's dig in. Drew, tell us about your farm ranch and where it is, how much land you work, geography, annual precipitation, that sort of thing.
Okay. This is a fourth generation farm. My wife is a kindergarten teacher, and with my son, he's to be the fifth generation. We farm about 2,500 acres, and then I have about 1,500 acres of pasture. And so we run about 150 head of mother cows. We fall calve, and I raise about 1,000 acres of winter wheat, soft white, about 400 or 500 acres of bluegrass, 200 acres of hay, and then we also raise canola, lentils, peas. We grow quite a diverse, different variety of crops. I live here in Nez Perce, Idaho, just outside of a small town, about 450 to 500 people. We started this cover crop grazing about 6 years ago. The NRCS came out and asked me to try something in growing these cover crops, and kind of started from there. Back then, I only ran about 40 head of cows because our pasture is very early pasture. So starting in, you know, early April, we can start to turn cows out, but it starts to dry up and burn up because of our weather. We receive about, anywhere from 18 to 25 inches of rain as our annual precipitation. And that primarily comes in the winter and early spring. And then about June, we don't receive any more rain until about October, November. So our growing season is fairly good, but we raise about half spring crops and half fall crops. The hay that we put up is alfalfa grass hay, and our pastures are mostly just a combination of cheatgrass and native grasses and a few weeds. Within that, the cow-calf operation that we run, we try to finish these calves, not finish them, but get them up to about 800 to 850 pounds before we sell them in like August, first part of September. So that's kind of the operation that we run. I farm with my son. He's 31 years old. I'm 58. And with that, I guess I would entertain any questions.
Yes, certainly. I've heard you say trying to improve the soil is your biggest goal. And I'm wondering if you could tell us about where you started moving from once you discovered that, okay, we are going to incorporate livestock in with our farming to improve, not only improve the soil, but it also creates a much varied operation for you as far as sales and everything else go, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And so when we started this process, they came out with kind of these cover crops, and we grew about a 15 species multi-seeded cover crop. And it was kind of interesting to see what would actually grow here. You know, a lot of things like turnips, radishes, green peas, lentils, black peas, a lot of brassicas, like spring canola or fall canola or even rapeseed, mixing those in. And watching those crops grow, and then we turned some cows out, and they had me put in some just regular barley. On these soils that I have here, it's kind of a clay loam, and I've been doing a lot of soil testing over the years. I have about 25 years, at least, of soil tests, and I forgot to say that I also became a direct seeder about 25 years ago. We changed our farming practices from plowing and cultivating to direct seeding. And we saw a huge benefit in the utilization of our moisture in converting to direct seeding. And in the soils itself at that time, going from my father's farming practices to direct seeding, we saw a huge increase in the worm population. And so it, primarily we took a look at the ground at that point going, you know, it's a living, growing thing that we need to be cognizant of or aware of, that there's things in the ground that we were affecting that we had no idea. And so when we started taking a look at the earthworms and then what earthworms do is breaking down organic matter and speeding up that process, and then taking a look at, well, we have cows, so we could graze them, and then taking a look at the soil tests over time, I've only been cover crop grazing for about 6 years, it really has changed our soils in those particular areas to improve water infiltration, water holding capacity. And one of my major issues in going into direct seeding was soil pH. And with the application of fertilizers, we started to see our soil pHs drop. And obviously, we want them in that 7 range. And I saw them go from 0.6s down to 5.2s. And now we see them coming back to 6 pH. And maybe even approaching 7 on some of them. And our organic matter over that same 20 years, we went from about 2.5% organic matter to about 4.5 to 5.5% organic matter. So our soils have changed quite a bit, but that process has been speeded up immensely by incorporating cattle into a rotation of the cover crops, and it speeds up the organic cycling immensely. Then I started reading, and I went to a speaking conference about my cover crop grazing, and I got to meet Gabe Brown and visit with him quite a bit. And we just took it a little bit further and a little bit further, and I can't see us now not having cover crop in our rotations. It's improved the soil so much, and it doesn't cost. It actually benefits.
Right.
So it's one of those things that we should have been doing this before, back when they had the land rush, you know, and everybody had fences. Well, over the last 30 years, everybody's tore out their fences except for myself. And now you see fences going back up and animals coming back to this ground.
Right.
And it's greatly improving it.
Yes. Now, in moving into cover cropping, what were some of the criteria you looked at deciding what types you wanted to have?
Well, I was trying to feed, you know, so all of a sudden we start doing these soil tests, and instead of just checking for NPK and those nutrients that wheat uses, we start thinking about the microorganisms and trying to feed those. What would benefit out here? A single species, a monoculture, is only feeding certain kind of microorganisms. And so looking at some of these things, we're still learning as far as kind of crops and what to put out there. We just threw a shotgun effect and seeing what we could actually grow. I can remember back when my dad was telling me they used to grow potatoes and they used to grow beans and a lot of other things out here. We grow beans and garbanzo beans and things like that now, but there for a while we were becoming very monoculture and just we were trying to focus on raising wheat. Now we try and focus on raising what the ground will produce and what we can actually get a return on. And the return that we can get on this cover crop is the cattle grazing and the pounds gained. They gain between 2 and 3 pounds a day. And our stocking rates are about 3 to 6 weight animals or a cow-calf pair per acre. That's been more our goal, is trying to figure out what can we use as a stocking rate on some of these fields. And how has that benefited our other pastures by rotational grazing those animals going from our regular pastures into these cover crops, and then utilizing that with fall calving to have those calves out there when they're about 4 to 5 weights in early June and letting them graze across those fields until about August, September. So we've looked at peas, lentils, brassicas, anything that we can actually get to grow a biomass that animals will eat and not cause them problem. We have neighbors now that are taking a look at, instead of just grazing cattle, they're grazing sheep, other animals and seeing if there's a way that they can utilize those to graze the cover crop and maybe do a better job on some of the weeds.
Right. I bet you did become a source of conversation for your neighbors.
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. They look at that and they kind of scratch their head a little bit. And, of course, you know, not everybody around here raises cattle.
Right.
But I've been approached and have done some custom grazing for some guys. And we are still working on that process. I know what the value is to the ground, but what do you charge somebody for grazing their animals and trying to figure out that return?
Right. Now, what have you seen with the health of the cattle? I'm sure being able to eat fresh grass rather than the dried is a huge difference.
It is. It is in the fact that anytime you're basically feeding the cows throughout summer and the calves, they're coming into the fall a lot better. That's their calving time, as we calve between August and September. The breeding back of those animals has become a lot better, a lot closer in cycling and a lot higher conception rates.
And that certainly speaks to the health of the animal always. And tell us about crops over maturing. And has there been a learning curve with that and figuring all of that out?
Yes, that is a very good point. So kind of depends on our year and depends on what kind of summer that we have. But I have shown and have pictures of green growing material because we even incorporated some warm seasons in like sedan grass and showing, I have pictures that show in the middle of the summer that we have green growing material for those cows to eat rather than dry grass or, you know, very little green. And so that has improved their health and our grazing. But in the maturing of the cover crop itself, I've baled it, I've bale grazed it, I have windrow grazed it, and we use electric fences and move them across these paddocks to do that. But I was able, in even some very extreme dry years, by growing the cover crop in the spring, we were able to utilize the feed in, say, windrowing it. We don't condition it. We don't do anything. We just leave it lay on the ground, and those cows fence across, and then they clean it up and eat it very well right in a windrow. Or I round bale for the most part, and I baled up some in the past and also left the bales there for grazing later into the fall. Most people around here are concerned about animals being out there and soil compaction and them running around in the mud. And every once in a while, that is somewhat of an issue. But if your ground starts to heal itself, it can heal itself from any of those kind of issues as well. Plus, the cover crop and the crop you're growing out there is being sped up and organically cycled through those animals. And my hope was also, and we have seen, that I have been able to reduce synthetic fertilizers and application of fertilizers.
Right. Are there any mistakes that you've made or the toughest thing that you've had to really move through and how you've moved through it?
Yeah, there's been mistakes. So like seeding spring barley, an on type of material that the cows tend to or not eat that stuff. And so you can create some problems as far as the species and types of plants that you put out there. If the cows don't eat them, then obviously you're not getting anything out of that. Right. Plus the fact that that creates more residue that you have to work with and potentially seeds surviving the winter and then becoming a problem within the next growing crop. I don't necessarily grow cover crop on the same acre every year. And so those I put back to like a winter wheat, because winter wheat is obviously the one that has been raised here for hundreds of years. And that's the primary cash crop for us around here. And so you don't want to necessarily affect or hurt that next wheat crop. But that was my concern before, was the crops growing, the cows eating them, and then using up all the moisture in the soil to plant the next wheat crop. But in the first year or two, that was a big concern. That doesn't concern me anymore. Our crops are more dependent on the rain and the moisture that we receive during the growing season and less on the winter snow and everything else that we get.
Now, do you think you would want to incorporate other types of livestock now?
Well, that's more and more what I'm looking at. But where we live, it's 60 miles to the first stoplight, let alone anywhere.
Stop bragging.
And my wife has chickens, and they eat the grain and whatnot. But they are something to go behind the cows. But Gabe is also one that uses multiple. He also runs hogs, pigs through the cover crop grazing, and then he utilizes chickens after that because the chickens will scatter the feces and the manure that the animals produce, and they'll pick through what those ruminants didn't necessarily utilize and better utilize any grain that travels through or any seeds. Birds are a big part that I could see in the future. It's a whole nother management issue, along with, you know, are you raising them to slaughter or are you raising them to raise eggs? And there's definitely demand for the eggs, but that becomes a major labor issue because that takes people.
Yes.
And so I haven't figured out a process for that yet.
Grandchildren.
Yes, exactly.
Many. What's been the most satisfying or gratifying thing about expanding your operation in this way?
Well, my wife and myself, so we live on the farm. And, of course, the crop acres that I till and we raise crops on are beautiful to look at. But it's really satisfying to look out there and open up a paddock to these cows and calves and see them dive into grazing this crop that I grew. And I'm harvesting that crop with those animals and seeing them really benefit. And it's just really good to look at the animals out my window of my house. And living on the farm, it's just nice to see those animals thriving.
Yes, absolutely. And the amount of time that you've had this focus, about 6 years, I believe you said, as far as the earth goes, that's really just a drop in the bucket of time.
Yeah.
With this focus for change. And how have you seen this focus perhaps affect other aspects of your life, or have you?
Well, it's trying to get a little bit more in balance, and in balance with Mother Nature. I see incorporating animals and becoming more of a whole system rather than just a monoculture is a benefit in the long run.
The variety is a spice of life, speaks everywhere,
yes.
Doesn't it? What can you either caution someone about? You just gave a lot of wonderful tips for someone who might be starting out or have various considerations with what they want to do. What's your best piece of advice at the moment?
Take a look at your ground and then realize that you're only here for a little while and you need to leave it better than you found it. And then getting into like cover crop grazing, water is a big issue. Water sources for those animals, because everybody needs water to survive. And I have a tanker and watering troughs, and I spend a lot of time hand watering these animals so that they get to know me and they get to be familiar with me so that I can keep them calm. And, you know, a calm animal will gain a lot more weight than somebody that's around frightened all the time. And so being out there with them is a big part of it.
Mm. I love that you just mentioned that bringing water and hand watering them, increasing your relationship to who they are and what they're doing and vice versa. That's really so smart.
Well, and it's kind of funny. I've taken pictures and taken some videos as well. But when we go out to move the cows to a new paddock, instead of running away and, you know, who's this guy, is they'll line up along that fence and they're waiting. They know what's coming. So we always set up the next paddock fence before they get in there, but they're coming to me rather than running away. And so it's easier to check those animals. It's easier to see any problem, of which I haven't, in the cover crops, I really haven't had any problems other than every once in a while they'll break down the fence. You know, and then you got to herd them back in. But as far as bloating and all of those things, they don't have any issues that way. They seem to be able to handle the green feed. And kind of like when you have a cover crop growing out there, you don't want to just eat steak every day. You want a variety. And so we try to put out the best variety that we think that they'll eat. And we're still learning exactly what those good things are and maybe what some of the bad things are. And that's a continued process. You know, I started this whole thing with the push from NRCS. And at any rate, I guess the point I was trying to make is I didn't think you could make any money or get any return off of this cover crop because I'm just harvesting in a different way. I'm harvesting with animals instead of a piece of equipment.
So bravo.
And then pushing me to try something new and try this, that was stepping definitely outside the norm and a lot of strange looks, not all bad, a lot of them good.
Right.
We have a similar thing going on here right now again.
Uh-huh.
It's a carbon machine. A couple of farmers, not me, but I would really like to participate in this. It costs about $100,000, but they're going away from fertilizer completely. And for this system to work, they are injecting carbon, the carbon exhaust out of their tractors and combines. And every pass that they make over the field, they're injecting carbon back into the ground and trying to work with Mother Nature and improving their soils.
Wow.
And they also do some grazing. But anytime that you start a process like that and you're working your way down through trying to figure out something new and something hugely beneficial to the earth, you have a lot of naysayers that sit out there and go, well, that'll never work.
Right,
That's stupid. You know, they're going to go broke. And these guys have gotten to the point where they have been direct seeding, just like myself, for quite a few years. But they're taking it to the next level. They want people to share their experiences and what they've done. And I asked a question one time, and it was kind of strange to hear. So why would you share? Why would you share this with anybody else? Because it could make a competitive advantage for you. For them and for this one gentleman, it was, okay, he just goes, because I want to improve the soil. You know, I'm only here for a little while.
Right.
And if I can get everybody else to change their thinking, then explain to me why that's a bad thing.
In this community of regenerative farmers, everyone wants what you just said. They want the earth to be able to be happy and thriving. It's really a beautiful thing that people finally turned around.
So to me, that process that they're using is the next step because they're taking the microbiology of the ground to the next level in focusing almost 90% more on the microbes and trying to feed them and trying to get the carbon back in the ground.
Right. Yeah, I haven't heard of this before.
This system?
Yeah.
It's Bioactive AG. You know, it's an expensive system. It's a complete stainless steel system that takes your exhaust system from your tractor and injects that through an air seeder back into the ground or through a regular seeder, but it would be getting away almost completely from synthetics.
Yeah, well, that's the way to go. Wonderful. Now, Drew, perhaps the most important question of all, what's your favorite steak?
Well, actually, I like a good tri-tip roast sliced into. So tri-tip is one that isn't necessarily the most desirable, but if it's cooked right and if you do everything right, it is very, very good.
And what's your tip for cooking it right? Or do we need to ask your wife?
Well, I use a rub, which is Cow Camp, and a Green Mountain Grill, which is a pellet grill.
All right.
And it takes several hours to do it correctly, but it's very good.
Mm, wonderful. Brad, rainwater harvesting is gaining in popularity for obvious reasons, yet it's an ancient practice as witnessed in many areas around the globe. Tell us about your experience in first learning about harvesting rainwater.
Yeah, so I guess my drive was initially kicked in by growing up in Tucson, a dry land community, and seeing our water situation get worse over time as we killed our river, the groundwater tables dropped, and so forth. But when I started to wake up to the potential of rainwater harvesting, I had witnessed as a kid these amazing summer storms, and I would play in all those storms, the flows of those storms. But it wasn't until I was an adult and kind of looked at the water issues or problems we were having, and then looking at the potential of this abundant rain when it falls, I just started making little basins next to my plantings, and I saw just how much the plants responded. Many people have found this when they water their house plants with rainwater as opposed to city water. They get much more vibrant growth because of the beneficial microorganisms and nutrients in the rainwater, and there's no toxic salts like you have in, in municipal water, surface waters. So I first noticed that, but what I was missing the boat on was the capacity. I was undersizing my basins. And as I was dwelling on this and experimenting, I also had the opportunity to travel to Southern Africa and visit Mr. Zephaniah Piri Maseka, who became my primary mentor. He was a subsistence farmer in the driest region of Zimbabwe. And he had taught himself and his family how to plant the rain, as he calls it, because he was politically active against at the time, the white Rhodesian government. And as a result, he was blacklisted, told he would never find another job again. So he had to figure out how to support his family of eight on an eroding landholding. So he'd go out in the rain and he'd notice when it rained, water would flow off the land and it'd take the soil and fertility with it. So that's not working. But he noticed in a few spots, water would be slowed down, maybe by a log or some rocks perpendicular to the slope. And these speed humps in the flow would allow sediment to drop out and fertility to increase, and moisture would linger longer. So he started mimicking these little things that he saw working. And over time, he developed an amazing system where he plants or infiltrates or invests more rain into his soils and the local system than is extracted from it through his hand-dug wells. So I got to visit him when he had established it to that point. And I was super impressed because when I compared the situation on his land to the adjoining farms, his was this amazing oasis, whereas theirs were relatively desiccated. And they were dependent on their pumps pumping groundwater, whereas Mr. Piri, the groundwater was rising to the roots of his crops. So seeing what this family had done with nothing more complicated than a shovel just blew me away. It's like, wow, anybody can do this. And then what set me on my current direction is I told Mr. Piri that I was concerned with the water situation where I lived, and I was thinking of leaving and asking him for advice on where I should think to go. And he said, well, you can't go. You have to go back. You have to set your roots deeper than you ever thought possible, and you have to figure it out. You have to turn these problems into solutions. Because if you just run away from your problems, you're going to plant and grow problems everywhere you go. But if you can figure out how to turn problems into solutions, well, you can go anywhere because you'll have that skill wherever you go. Obviously, the problems and their solutions will change, but you'll have that ability to think and work through it. So I came home supercharged and got to work.
Yes, it certainly sounds like it. And in hearing your story, it feels like your path was set to bring awareness and these practices back to your home. Tell us how you got started and what benefits you've seen. And you are actually more in a city area, and I would like to speak a little bit about how this can be used and is used by farms and ranches as well. But tell us about what's going on for you right there in Tucson.
Yes, we live just on the northern edge of downtown Tucson. And one of the first projects where we really got going was with a neighborhood native food forestry project. Most of our street sides were barren, just these hot solar oven-like experiences, treeless. So you didn't want to be out and about on the neighborhood streets. We started this program where we first plant the rain, inspired by Mr. Piri Maseko. We plant the rain in these water harvesting basins, and then we plant native food-bearing low water use trees. And this worked great, and the neighborhood immediately felt transformed, even just with these small 5-gallon trees in place, because all of a sudden people saw, wow, people care. People are stepping up. But the thing that we missed the boat on is our basins were way undersized, and we were missing the bulk of the free available water. We were capturing direct rainfall, but what we were missing was the street runoff in the adjoining streets. I later did calculations, and I found that the average residential street in Tucson, where we just get 11 inches of rain a year, drains over 1 million gallons of street runoff per mile per year. So if we were to redirect that street runoff to street-side basins that were large enough to hold that and infiltrate that water, as opposed to just drain it down the street gutter, we'd have enough water to freely irrigate over 400 trees per mile, or one tree every 25 feet on both sides of the street. The streets provide enough water to shade every street with a food-bearing shelter belt of living shade. So we evolved our program. We started making larger basins, made the basins lower than the street, and then we started to direct street runoff into the basins. And this was illegal at the time, not directing the water into the basins, but the way we got the water to the basins, which is we cut a street curb to direct street runoff to the basin. So we did this on a Sunday when no one from the city was watching. And we started small. We started at the top of the watershed where there's a manageable amount of runoff that we were dealing with. And we worked through the issues and evolved our design. And neighbors saw how well this was working. The initial plantings were working great, but these were really working great, much better. So we started building a political will for this because a lot of neighbors wanted to do likewise. And I said, okay, well, before you go and do so, let's try and legalize this. So we approached the city. It took a few years, but we, through multiple meetings, we were able to legalize this practice using our pre-legal interventions as a pilot project. And now it's not only legalized, it's incentivized with a $2,000 rebate and mandated in all new road construction and renovation. So that was an amazing shift.
Amazing,
I think,
yes.
Yeah. And I think it shows the power of how small interventions and small actions, what power they can have to inspire larger change.
Yes. Now, Brad, what year was this where it became legal?
2007, it became legal.
Okay, so have you seen other cities or heard, have other people contacted you and said, how did you do it? We want to do this in our city?
Yeah, definitely. A number of cities have done so. And other cities were actually doing this before we started. So, but as opposed to being a citizen-initiated effort, it was a city-initiated effort. So the city of Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington, both of those cities were already doing it. It wasn't a grassroots-led thing. So we were inspired by that, and their work actually was pretty huge in helping us legalize things in Tucson because our city officials saw that other city officials were doing this, and that dropped their fear threshold.
Of course, yes. And can you be a little more specific about how you make the basins? What are they made of? Where do they get placed? Just to give us a better picture.
Yeah. The great thing is we're not importing soil or exporting soil. So we dig a basin typically 2 feet from the street curb towards the property. But again, this is in the public right-of-way where you typically have, you know, sidewalks and stuff. So we want it, the basins between the street and the walkway. So we have the easiest access of the street runoff. And then we can grow a tree between walkway and street that more beneficially shades both walkway and street and creates a physical barrier between cars and people. And the basins are minimum 1 foot deep. And now, the way we do it, they're a minimum 8 feet long and 5 feet wide. That way, we have an annual stormwater harvesting capacity of over 4,500 gallons per basin per year.
So what about the safety for people walking along the street?
We actually enhance the pedestrian experience as we do this. So we widen the public walkways to a minimum 5 foot width, so that people can walk side by side, and it encourages people to move through this more readily. And we remove stuff that impedes easy walking or wheel rolling, such as gravel. We get rid of that, so we have a smooth surface. We don't have the money for concrete sidewalks, so we just compact the native soil. And then we line the banks of the basins with rock or logs from neighborhood prunings. Or we even use urbanite, which is broken up sidewalk chunks, but we do it in a very beautiful way, very carefully set all the different pieces. And that creates a visual delineation between what's basin and what's path. The other visual delineation is the paths are flat and raised, whereas the basins are very obviously sunken. And then we mulch the basins with an organic matter mulch that enhances soil life and water infiltration and absorption. And that mulch is another visual delineation. And then we plant the basins heavily. We're not just planting trees, we're planting all strata of the food forest within these basins. So we've got trees and larger shrubs and smaller shrubs and ground cover, tuber roots, vines, cacti, all of this stuff in its appropriate microclimate. On the sides of the basins, we have a raised terrace. It's like a step. So it's not a sudden drop down. It's a step down. So we have three distinct microclimates. The bottom, which is the wettest, and so we plant the most water-tolerant needy species there. On the terrace, the less water-tolerant needy species, because the terrace is higher than the bottom. And then we've got the top, where we can plant the least water-tolerant needy species. As that vegetation then grows, it's all very small when we plant it. We don't plant anything larger than a 5-gallon size plant. But as it grows, it creates this vertical element, which is another visual delineator, so people can't go through. And if someone did fall in, they would fall into soft vegetation and mulch, and they could easily step out via the stepped terrace.
Right. Beautiful.
But we have no reported cases of anyone falling in.
Oh, good. Well, I just so love the visual of planting rain. And I've heard you say the main concepts are universal, and what changes is the specific strategy. Can you share an example perhaps now of what a rancher farmer might do or use? You've just told us a little bit about what city dwellers do.
Yeah. So let me first say that the main thing that's going to change as you shift from one geographic location to another is the plant palette. But the basic concept of planting the rain, of creating these earthworks or topography that slows down and infiltrates the flow of stormwater runoff, that remains constant. But you always want to be using plants that are best adapted for your soils, climate, and wildlife. So you native plants the easiest to succeed with. So when we go to a ranch or farm setting, oftentimes where we begin is trying to capture runoff from compacted surfaces, in this case, dirt roads as opposed to paved roads. Oftentimes on a farm or a ranch, the infrastructure that is costing the most money to the rancher and the farmer and causing the most problems are the dirt roads, because typically they intercept the water flowing across the landscape, and then the road or the driveway becomes the waterway. And it's continually eroding out and creating maintenance headaches while dehydrating the land on the downstream side of it. A mentor of mine, Bill Zedike, has developed a wonderful system which he calls rolling dips. So he basically, every 300 to 500 feet, will create a very gradual dip in the road that's at a diagonal to the road. It's a dip and then a rise, kind of a speed hump rise. So this diverts all water off the road. And what's much better than just a roadside ditch is, with just a roadside ditch, water continues to flow down the wheel ruts, continues to flow down the road. Whereas with this rolling dip, the water cannot continue down the wheel ruts. And then instead of directing the water into a narrow, deep roadside ditch, you direct the water to a shallow, spread out roadside drain. So you're trying to slow down and spread out the flow of water, not speed it up and concentrate it. So you strategically place these drains where you can have maximum benefit to the landscape. So you discharge them into gradually sloping areas where you get maximum spread of the water throughout, say, roadside pastures or fields, as opposed to an area that's going to create an erosive gully. In Altar Valley, southwest of Tucson, this strategy has resulted in waist-high grasses, you know, incredible fodder for the livestock and the wildlife. Now, another step you can do within agricultural fields, farms, ranches, is within the pastures themselves, within the fields themselves, as opposed to creating a system that drains the rain, you're just creating multiple interventions, very simple ones, that are all trying to slow down, spread out, and infiltrate more of the rain. And you're also investing not in synthetic fertilizers, which don't help soil life. You're instead investing in organic matter, amendments that are going to feed the soil life, which in turn feeds the vegetation. And that organic matter and that living soil life is continually creating billions of channels into the soil so the rainwater can more quickly infiltrate rather than run off. And then all that organic matter also acts like a sponge, which holds on to the moisture much longer into the dry time. Whereas if you're, you know, just doing synthetic fertilizer and don't have much life in the soil organic matter, it can't hold on to that moisture.
Right.
So it's two things. On the surface, you're slowing down, spreading out the water, and below the surface, you're creating more life and sponge-like qualities that hold on to that moisture so it lingers longer into the dry season.
That's beautiful. So in that area you just spoke about where the grasses are now 5 feet, how long a time period do you think that took once they started focusing on this method for planting and saving water?
Okay, that's always going to be highly variable. Okay. It's going to depend on your rains. It's going to depend on the health of your soil when you start mm-hmm. and the amount of seed stock already in the system. So there are sections of that ranch where you have very noticeable difference with the first good rainy season. But then there are other sections of the ranch that took many years to start to turn around because the soils had already been so eroded and depleted
right.
that the organic matter and seed stock had to be built back up before it became much more noticeable.
Well, this is nothing less than magical to me, for sure. And the bonus, ultimately, what I'm hearing is that it all leads to less work, ultimately, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. The other great thing about these rainwater harvesting earthworks, or this, you know, water slowing, spreading, sinking topography, is it doesn't just capture rainfall and runoff, which you turn into run in, okay?
Yes.
So it runs into the soil, not off of it, is it's also capturing leaf drop. It's capturing the manure from the birds and the insects and the vegetation. So you're continually building your organic matter and your topsoil at the same time. So it's like this win-win.
Absolutely, yes.
Because everything moves with gravity, you know, unless there's a lot of money behind a pump or something. So we're creating a system that embraces the free distribution of gravity.
Mother Nature at its best, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Brad, is there anything in closing you would like to share that I didn't touch on or that you haven't had the opportunity to as yet?
I guess, while the books and the websites are fantastic resources, don't forget to just spend some time in the healthy pockets of your local ecosystem, because the natural world has, for me, been my primary teacher and continues to be my primary teacher and inspiration. As Mr. Peary, my mentor, did, you go out into these healthy pockets and you see what's working, and go out during the rainy times, go out during the dry times, and try and figure out why that's working, and then try and mimic those aspects that are working in various ways back in the built environment. And that way, you know, the knowledge is freely available as nature is our living encyclopedia.
David, part of your expertise in working with all things ecological, and maybe emphasis is on logical, is water. And for today's conversation, dowsing for water. In studying dowsing, what main point did you take away from reading Kenneth Roberts' book about Henry Gross and his dowsing rod?
Well, the first thing right away was, as a guy who took graduate level physics when I was a freshman, when I read that book, I realized this violates the laws of science. And I decided that if I had a chance to investigate this, I was definitely going to look into this, because this was an oddity among the things that I learned in 20-some years of studying science. And it actually doesn't violate science. It just opens up a whole new dimension of science that we're not processing well in today's society. As I say, when I teach people how to douse, every body is a water body. So, of course, you can find water. It's what you're made out of. Water is one of the key ingredients for life. I say it's the first ingredient to make life happen, is you need to have clean, pure water. So it's the beginning of the whole process of building life. That's what we look for when we go to the moon and go to Mars. We're looking for water because that's one of the conditions needed to support life. So water is a very fundamental part of our reality, but yet water is not well understood by modern science. And there are certain things about water that are not perceived well the big area where this is happening is something called structured water. Water we think of as being a liquid and being shapeless, but within that shapelessness, water actually forms structures and organizes itself. So we're learning that biological organisms need access to this kind of structured water, and we're learning how to create it, how to manipulate it, how to understand its usefulness in biology. So this is just one little area where we're learning that water has unusual properties that are necessary and essential for life to happen.
You have a long list of those you've helped find water, of course, from municipalities in the U.S. to desert regions in India, where you were dubbed the Water Angel. Would you recount that story for us?
Yeah. Unexpectedly, out of the blue, in 2006, I was invited to go to India and speak at the Second World Council of Elders of Ancient Traditions and Cultures. And I managed to get there, and it turned out it was in western India, in Jaipur, which is out in the desert in Rajasthan. I had traveled on a bus 6 hours across India and watched us slowly descend into the desert. So when I got to the bus station, I went in the corner of the bus station, and I was standing there with a dowsing rod investigating how water circulates underground halfway around the world under a desert, because that was something I really wanted to learn about. And as I was standing in the bus station with this dowsing rod, people wondered what I was doing with this little metal rod, watching it wiggle back and forth. And somebody asked, "What are you doing?" And so I explained to them that I was studying how water circulates under the ground. And they said, "You can do that?" And I said, "Sure." And I explained it to them. And pretty soon a crowd would gather. Mm-hmm. And eventually the question would come, "Well, can I do that?" And I would say, "Sure, let me teach you." I had 5 dowsing rods, and I would use one, and I would have 2 people and teach them in front of a little crowd how to douse, how to locate water underground, and show them that they can do this. So this proved to be a regular event. Whenever I'd have a chance, I would stop, and I would start doing some investigation of water, and every time someone would ask me. And so after this happened, like the 4th time, I think it was at lunch, the first day of the conference, a reporter came over and asked me what was going on, and he said, "Well, can I write an article about you?" And I said, "Well, sure, it's all right." So he interviewed me, took some pictures, and the next day my picture and the article appeared in the local paper. It was in Hindi, and I had no idea what the article was about. But the conference was deluged with calls from me to go find water for farms out in the desert, and they allowed me to leave the conference and go out and do that 3 times. Third farm that I visited, the farmer's son translated the article for me, and what I discovered was that the reporter, in describing how I doused, I had explained that I used the angle of the rod to point to the answer. And so by a little flip of linguist here, the word angle became angel, and the article was titled "Water Angel Visits India." I thought that was just delightful, because in America, I'm known as a witch. It's called water witching.
Yes.
In France, you find the source of water, you're called the sorcerer. I've had people tell me I can't douse on their property because it's not Christian. This is a big problem with dowsing. It has a negative reputation in the West. And one other piece of this is the last day of the conference. The director of the Department of Hydrogeology for the state of Rajasthan came to the conference and asked me if I would talk to his staff about what I do. So I got to talk to about 20 people that are the hydrogeology staff of the whole state and explain to them what I do. And it was quite fun, because in India, I could say a very simple thing, that we have this science of how to locate water, but there is a spiritual method of approaching water. And in India, they have a serious spiritual culture. So they immediately fell into liking what I was talking, and I left my dowsing rod on the coffee table, and after I was done talking, they picked them up and were playing with them. I was quite amused to see that if I was to come back and teach them, they would definitely get this and they would put this to good use. The capstone of that trip was to be able to talk to the professional hydrogeologist and introduce them to this method of locating water sources.
Yes, absolutely. And when you did go help the various farmers, it's one thing to find You go, oh, there's water here, but it's not necessarily where you want to put your well.
Yeah, it says in the I Ching, you can move the village, but you can't move the well. That's a very profound statement.
David, was there an aha moment for you in learning about dowsing where you felt, oh, okay, I get this now?
It goes on all the time because I'm always learning new things. One of my problems when I learned how to douse is that I was the only person I knew that could douse. And so I had no backup. I had no second chair that I could use to confirm what I was learning and experiencing. So what I used to do is I used to teach people how to douse, and I would go out and douse with them and compare what they detected with what I detected. And that was always a terrific moment. Suddenly the dowsing rod would pivot around, and they would, the look on people's face, they feel like I'd put a spell on them or enchanted them. Something magical just happened. It's the look of utter astonishment that comes over people's faces is quite fun. One of the people that I taught was the chief of the Onondaga Nation. He was the guy that located water in his community. And so we got together one time, and we were dowsing a well for one of his cousins. And he got this big, thick, heavy apple branch. It was probably like 2 feet long and a good inch and a half in thickness, and it was very awkward and heavy to use. And I had these little metal rods and plastic handles that pivoted around, and he was quite fascinated by my tools. And then I mentioned to him that the water we were dousing the spring was 33 feet deep. He said, you can do that? And I said, yeah, let me explain it to you. And so I told him how to do depth. He already could douse. And so I gave him my metal rods, and he's standing there holding them, and he's doing what I did. He's got his eyes closed, and I can see his lips are moving, and he's counting off the number of feet down in the ground. And as he's counting, the rods suddenly start to move. They start to pivot, and his eyes open a little bit, and he looks down at them through the slit of his eyes. And as the rods slowly move around until they're lined up in front of him, his eyes get bigger and bigger and bigger until they're wide open. And he looks straight at me, and he says, it speaks Indian. I spoke to an Indian, and it answered me. I laughed. That was so cute.
Yes, honestly.
The look, again, that look on his face, that precious innocence of astonishment. And I said, yes, Leon, the intuitive mind speaks all languages.
A longer form of that interview with David Yarrow will be aired soon on Tributaries Radio. Many thanks to David and also to Drew Leach and Brad Lancaster. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.